duck, duck, goose! Duck and Minerva in the stereo.
Hi, this is Dan Nexon, and you are listening to episode number 16 of the Duck of Minerva podcast. In this episode, I talk with Robert Farley, a very prominent academic blogger who blogs at Lawyers, Guns, and Money, about what it means to be a scholar and a blogger. We spent a great deal of time discussing the ecology of the blogosphere and how it's altered over the last 8 to 10 years. We particularly focus on the politics blogosphere in the United States and how the left side of the blogosphere behaves differently from the right side of the blogosphere. And then we go on to talk about different models of academic blogging and different purposes of academic blogging. And we have some, I hope, friendly criticisms of some of the most prominent academic blogs, not in terms of what's wrong with them, but about how they're not the only kind of model that academic bloggers might think about emulating. Hi, this is Dan Nexon, and today I've got Rob Farley on. Rob, are you there?
I'm here. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm pretty solid.
So Rob is probably well known to many of our listeners as one of the, seven amigos behind Lawyers, Guns, and Money, one of the most popular sort of left-wing blogs with an academic tilt. I think that there's been some studies that locate you pretty much at the center of the left-wing blogosphere, which is an interesting kind of thing. But you may be less familiar to some of our more purely academic listeners. And so I thought it might be useful if you just spent a few minutes talking about yourself and your academic background.
Right. My name is Rob Farley. I am at the Patterson School of Diplomacy and International Commerce at the University of Kentucky. And the Patterson School is a terminal MA program. It's been around since 1959, public policy, or a foreign policy program, more than public policy. My work, I was trying to think of a catchy phrase for my work. I guess how I would characterize my work is that I am particularly interested in how state security decisions, and especially defense decisions, diverge from realist expectations. And that is intended as no prejudice against realism, right? But it's rather how do the details of how states go about making defense decisions differ from what you might expect from sort of rational utility maximizing states in anarchy trying to maximize their own security. And so I do diffusion, I do military doctrine, prestige and how prestige affects military acquisition and so forth. It's all around that.
And you've actually made some very interesting arguments that might be somewhere we take this, which have to do with the need to abolish the Air Force, right? The argument that the Air Force really works better as a component of the Army or the Navy or another service with particular kind of missions.
Right, right. I mean, one of the insights, and this goes all the way back to Graham Allison and probably even before Allison, but certainly comes out in Allison, is that the state foreign policy is to some extent a function of the organizations you plug into it, right? And so granting a particular organization a seat at the table, which making an independent Air Force does, privileges to some extent the use of air power versus other kinds of military force in defense decisions and civilian political decisions. And I argue by and large, with respect to independent air forces, especially in the United States and the United Kingdom, that has been a baneful rather than a beneficial influence on state policymaking, sort of both on the wars we end up getting ourselves involved in, but also in how we fight wars and how we prepare to fight wars.
So one of the things that I was thinking about asking you, and I'm now worried that the premise is wrong, is if I remember back to some of your posts from many years ago at LGM, Lawyers, Guns, and Money, you mentioned that you were probably not somebody who years and years ago we would have associated with the left wing of American politics, and that this has been a sort of journey for you that, if I recall correctly, has a lot to do with foreign policy. Is that right?
I mean, I think that that's true. It's you know, and I, it's a very, no, why do we talk about my political and intellectual journey? Certainly while I was an undergraduate, I conceived of myself as a conservative. And while I was a graduate student, I was conceived of by others as occupying sort of the right side of graduate student space. Now, you and I know that the right wing of graduate student space, you know, often seems is simply how many Molotov cocktails ought we to throw and at which targets during the revolution. And so, you know, in terms of the sort of the modern contemporary political context, that may not mean very much. But I think it's also fair to say that the foreign policy behavior of especially the first term of the George W. Bush administration was certainly significant in how I thought about American politics, and was significant in how I thought about change in American politics, or not change, but ideology in American politics.
And that was simply a backlash to the Iraq War and the neoconservative foreign policy agenda as they articulated it, or was there something else there?
No, I mean, I think that was the main thing. I mean, I recollect on the you know, sort of while the election was playing out, and I considered myself a Democrat in 2000, and to the best of my recollection, I voted for Gore, although. Yeah, I'm pretty sure I voted for Gore. I know I didn't vote for Bush anyway. But I recall firmly believing that, well, at least in terms of foreign policy, there's no significant serious issue, right? That what we have here is a competent, well-led team with professional foreign policy hands who are unlikely to do anything crazy or stupid. And moreover, that there is a great likelihood that Republican Party, or that the Republican Secretary of Defense, will bring the uniformed military to heel in a way that the Clinton administration was completely unable to do. I think it's fair to say that those expectations were not rewarded with regards to Bush foreign policy.
Now, I'm mentioning very quickly your academic scholarly background, your ideological journey to being a major presence in, as I said, the left-wing blogs here, because I want to connect this all kind of together and ask you about your thoughts about being, you know, an academic who is also a blogger and a very successful one, and how this all kind of came to pass.
You know, I mean, it's interesting because it came to pass, I think, almost. Well, and let's not get around ahead of ourselves when we say a very successful one, right? You know, the blog is very successful, and I do the accounting. So, but there has been some professional success that the blog has led to. You know, we founded the blog, myself and Dave Watkins and Scott Lemieux, in 2004 when we were all still graduate students, but we were approaching, at least two of us were approaching graduation and finishing our PhDs, as a way to ensure that we would all be in contact with one another as the traditional academic diaspora occurred, right? That you have lots of friends in graduate school, but they're always temporary friends, right? Because you're dispersed across the country. It is interesting that I suspect that if Facebook had come something like 3 years earlier, we might never have felt an urge to do that, because there would have been an automatic way to keep in touch. Right? We would have been following each other without sort of having the same sort of interactions. I think that at the time, none of us really expected that there would be much in the way of serious interaction between our academic careers and our blogospheric careers, both because there was no good template for how that would play out, and because we couldn't envision a good way in which the blogging would help our academic careers. We could envision some bad ways in which it could, but we couldn't envision a good way, and so we just didn't really think about it. Especially in my case, ending up at a policy school like the Patterson School, where you still have a traditional academic focus, but you also have a very deep sort of policy interest that you don't have in a lot of political science departments, certainly helped propel the blog forward and the blogging forward, in that I was inclined to write policy-oriented work, and there was an assumption that policy-oriented work would be welcome, right? That engagement with the public sphere would be welcome in a way that it wouldn't necessarily be welcome in a traditional academic position.
So in a sense, you think that a lot of what happened for you was sort of contingent on the one hand, you know, this decision to start up a blog for very personal reasons. And maybe we need to get the timeline a bit down about when the blog began to really kind of take off as a destination for, you know, for people now. I mean, it's posts can have hundreds of comments. It's a very vibrant intellectual and political community. But so there's that kind of thing. But then at Patterson, you really think that a lot has to do with the notion that just there is institutional support or recognition that what you do is valuable.
Yeah, well, sort of in terms of the timeline, what we have to remember is the blogosphere is not what it – so we founded the blog in, I think, on May 31st, 2004. The blogosphere is not today what it was then, either in traffic patterns or in congeniality. And so, I mean, at the time, we had what was trivial readership compared to what we have now, where we would have 500, 600 a day, and we would be staggered that we'd have that much. And other major bloggers would be talking to us and contacting us because we were significant, because we had 500. That's obviously – that's no longer how the blogosphere works. I wouldn't say – I think we can get into this. This is – because I think this is an interesting conversation. I wouldn't say that with regards to the Patterson School, there has ever been explicit – support of why don't you go out and blog on your home blog, because that would be fantastic for the Patterson School. There's never been an argument of that sort made, and I've never had the feeling that that was something that sort of was understood or would be rewarded. But at the same time, there is this sense that public engagement is a good thing, and so I ought to be doing things that are engaged in public engagement, or that are part of public engagement, and the blog was part of that.
I'm thinking about this because this is really, I think, what we're going to wind up talking about is the sort of academia blogging interface and about the nature of the blogosphere and how it's changed and things that to us may be, you know, stuff we're fairly familiar with, but I think to a lot of our readership is going to be news. Readership? Did I say readership? I meant listenership. I should note that we're recording this at 10 p.m. and I've been right. There's apparently a hashtag for me on graduate student email called Tipsy Nexon. So, but I've had a little bit to drink on the theory that that it's at night and I've been taking care of my daughter by myself for a couple of days. So I deserve it. Well, damn it.
I mean, I'm consuming an old fashioned, made with, some, 1729. So I'm actually quite happy myself.
Okay. Well then we can loosen up and have a lot of fun.
There we go.
But seriously, so but I do think that there's a lot of ignorance and confusion and just a lot of lack of knowledge among academics, about blogging and about the blogosphere or blog land or whatever we want to call it. And yet there's an increasing kind of push to engage with it.
Right.
So I think that you've sort of started to tell us some of the parameters. So back in 2004, having 500 to 600 people a day was a lot for a blog that wasn't, at the tippy top of the tier of blogging, right? It meant that you were basically in the top 5% or something like that, like political blogs. The top 1%, yes, was bigger. But you're still way up there.
Right.
And Now, well,
if I could pause you for a second, it's interesting because, I mean, and what I said, the patterns of readership have changed, right? That, and you know, I would have to go out and actually look at the statistics myself to make sure, but for a while, what we now consider sort of the biggest blogs, you know, Daily Kos is still very large, and Atreus has fallen off considerably, but it was once very large. Those in 2004 and 2005, had readership which is higher than it is today. So there was very concentrated readership on these top blogs, but there were still these mid-major blogs that were considerably smaller than a mid-major blog is today. And so I think in some sense, a lot of the traffic has diffused from these sort of very large, politically concentrated blogs to a more sort of middle strata of blogs, not unlike LGM, that get something like 15,000 a day, rather than the, you know, the what Daily Kos would get, which would be, you know, 500,000 a day in a regular day in the middle of a non-election year.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, I think that clearly one of the things, if I think back to 2004, 2005, was that, you know, the world of quality blogs, particularly ideological blogs, whatever side of the spectrum you're on, was significantly smaller than it is now. And it was, but at the same time, it was sort of the big kind of amalgamation aggregation movement was just getting underway. It was a very kind of, and it was much more Wild West, I suppose. So what are so, but you answered my question, which is, so once upon a time you would get 500 to 600, now you get maybe 15,000 a day. And I assume that a significant percentage of those are not what we term bounces. That is, people who are going there because there's an image that shows up on Google, or you know, and then disappear within 5 seconds. So that's what, you know, probably what's your bounce rate, about 2-3%,
something like that. I'm not sure exactly. Another interesting development in the blogosphere has been that people are increasingly reluctant to click on links, and that this seems, you know, for reasons that I'm sure have some, there's some sort of good reason for that, like clicking on links has caused more pop-ups or something, I don't know. But, you know, even a link from a major website supplies less traffic than it did in 2005.
Yeah, I remember if you could get LinkedIn from a high-tier blog, it would just be, you know, we talked about it as, you know, a so-and-so bomb, right? You would get all sorts of traffic. And even now, if we get a link in at someplace like The Duck from Andrew Sullivan, it generates a lot of traffic, but it's not – we can get more traffic through a post that goes viral on Twitter than we can get from where you have to click through to see what it's about than we can from, you know, a major media-backed blog. So all right. So we've actually now laid out a couple of differences. One is that a blog like Lawyers, Guns, and Money, which, you know, is a kind of premium blog in the academic, sort of the left-wing blog sphere with some academic tie-in that's been around for a while, gets about 15,000 a day, which to academic readers is probably or listeners is probably mind-blowing. But in internet terms, it's very strong, but it's not insane, right? The second is that people, there's much less movement away from, say, your home blogs. That is, people are not clicking through to more things. People are not, the conversation is a little bit less vibrant across blogging, I think, than it used to be. Is that, or at least the extent to which people are following those conversations across different blogs is less vibrant.
Well, I mean, certainly, you know, one aspect that was true, that was common in the blogosphere in 2004 and 2005, was the cross-ideological conversation, where you had good, vibrant, violent conversations between the left and the right blogosphere. And this has almost entirely ceased to exist. To the extent you have conversation, it is mockery rather than engagement. And I think that's true on both sides.
It's almost become an expected feature, right? That any good politically tilted blog worth its salt will have a mockery.
Right.
Either a blogger who devotes a good proportion of his or her posting to mockery, or somebody who, or at least, you know, you expect a mockery post once every couple of days at a minimum. Which is a kind of interesting tradition if you think about it. But what do you think's caused that?
You know, that's a really good. I mean, I suspect that it has something to do with the sort of rewards associated with persistence in readership and the rewards associated with commenters. You know, commenters do not provide any sort of real reward, but they are incredibly annoying. And when you, back in the day when we had cross-blog conversations, or cross, and some people say sort of left Blogovia and right Blogistan, when you had conversations between those, the commenters would go in either direction, and it would create incredibly unpleasant comment threads where, you know, the posters were viciously attacked and misinterpreted and so forth. And so I think there were psychic costs to those kinds of. But there also were relatively few rewards, because those incredibly annoying commenters only came once, right? They didn't come back any time. Whereas if you start up a good conversation with a sort of a left academic blog like Crooked Timber or something like that, you got readers who might be genuinely interested in your work, and who might come back and who might leave interesting, productive comments, and your traffic might go up over time rather than just one day where you're having an argument with Josh Trevino or Ace of Spades or somebody on the right.
So you think it was primarily about, from your perspective, the degree to which you do it is a function of, you know, what the sort of rewards and punishments are, and it's just more punishing. Right. It's not worth the effort.
I don't think I ever thought about it. You know, I have thought about the reasons why this has happened a number of times since then. I don't think at the time I ever thought about it in terms of I'm a sort of a Skinnerian. I'm gonna tap and get my pleasure palette, and attacking the right blogosphere doesn't do that. But, you know, I can certainly probably remember times where I considered writing a post about something in the right blogosphere, and it's just I don't want to bother. Right? There's no upside to this. I don't want angry people infesting my blog that I'm going to have to deal with their comments. And after a while, this simply becomes habit.
It's interesting because from my perspective, you know, I occupy a very different niche in blog land, right? We have a blog that's much, much smaller. I mean, our traffic was very comparable to what you describe as your early small traffic until really the last 2 or 3 years. And even then, it's not that much higher. I mean, I think we're probably at about 1,000 a day on average of non-bounce, you know, traffic. And for unique visits. But, you know, I do remember back in the heyday of things that you're describing. And so my subjective understanding of it was that there was a point in the foreign policy debates where things were scrambled in interesting ways and the stakes were really high. Right. And there was some amount of common discourse that enabled conversation. So, you know, just arguments over Bush foreign policy could get people who didn't normally associate with the right wing defending right wing positions, or didn't normally associate with the left wing defending right. what were prominently left wing positions. And which, you know, particularly because neoconservatism is this variant of liberal internationalism, you know, people might agree that there was something to be said about spreading democracy, but you could have debates over the mechanisms that were best for that. Right. Because the war on terror was so visceral, and because, again, the stakes were high, and again, because I thought there was foreign policy is a kind of interesting animal to argue over, you know, I felt a need to engage, and I felt like there was a lot of engagement. And then there were also these blogs that were sort of constituted themselves as middle ground blogs, or blogs that people kind of agreed on, let's get tough on Al-Qaeda, but weren't entirely sure they agreed about everything, so they provided meeting places.
Right.
And I felt like the benefits of that dropped out, the robustness, the richness of that dropped off in part because a lot of those linking blogs disappeared, whether it was because people kind of lost interest or because the abject failure that was Iraq disheartened people who'd kind of temporarily move further to the right. I don't know what it was. So part of it was, it seemed like the blogs that had some respect on both sides either lost respect or they disappeared. I also felt like, you know, the stakes did decline, right, as Iraq just became, I mean, they didn't decline for in the real world, but there was not much left to argue over when it just became, what's the timetable for withdrawal, right?
Right.
and in which in that sense that the Bush doctrine had clearly spent itself.
Right.
And by the time that we get to 2008, where I think the blog sphere has changed a great deal, I don't know. I just found the cross conversation dispiriting. I found the level of discourse so poor that it wasn't worth it. But I don't know. I mean, that's a very impressionistic view, and it's not one motivated by kind of the same kind of considerations.
Right. I'm curious. I'm fascinated about sort of the disappearance of these middle linkage blogs, because some of them certainly did exist. Some of them sort of, you know, eventually just kind of disappeared, and some of them kind of moved decisively in one direction or another, right? You know, sort of Andrew Sullivan kind of occupied the space a long time ago, but he very decisively moved in one direction with regards to foreign policy. I mean, the only space that I can think of that still occupies anything close to what might be a middle ground would be James Joyner's blog, the sort of outside the Beltway. You know, I think it's outside the Beltway blog. But even that, I think, is linked more often from sort of left bloggers and foreign policy people than from right bloggers.
Yeah, yeah. Outside the Beltway is really interesting because, you know, if you look at the editorial content across, you know, they have some more left and more right bloggers. Mm-hmm. It is pretty middle of the road. And, you know, James himself is pretty middle of the road, right? I think he wound up, I think he was a Romney supporter in the end, but you couldn't necessarily tell from what he would blog on a day-to-day basis. But if you look at the commentary at that blog, the commentators are overwhelmingly left.
Right.
And that tells you something, I think, about the ecology of the blog, of what we've been calling the blog sphere, which is that, which is this other side of it, which is that the traffic rewards for linking into the quote unquote echo chamber also seem to be more rewarding. Or more positive. I mean, I don't know if that's right on the left. I know on the right it really is, right? I mean, there's almost an outbidding process among conservative blogs that I think you see to some degree, but I don't know. I mean, I don't read them enough anymore, but do you have things that are comparable to, has this election sparked things that are comparable to the kind of Greenwald versus, you know, the Farley types of the world, the Scott Lemieux of the world, kind of smackdowns we're seeing, you know, that we see on the between left and liberals. I mean, you're going through you had a very nice post tonight, actually, about this issue about liberals versus the left and contingent alignment and stuff like that.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I don't think that dynamic has. I mean, there may be a reason why that dynamic hasn't taken place on the right. I mean, certainly you have echoes of that kind of dynamic. You had arguments between sort of how to approach Romney, but you know, from what I could tell, broadly speaking, the right bloggers were able to line up behind Romney without a tremendous amount of trouble, and they saved their backbiting for the day after. And it's at that point that sort of the noose was fitted for Jennifer Rubin and other people who were viewed as critical in bringing Romney about, whereas in the left blogosphere, you know, I think even in 2008, but especially in 2012, you have had very vicious divides between people who, between sort of that dynamic and however you want to characterize it, right, between left radicals and liberals, and it's almost you know, from a political science perspective, it's almost less interesting for the content than it is for just how the patterns develop, right? Why does there appear to be a different traffic structure and a different incentive structure in right Blogistan than in left Blogovia? And I honestly, you know, I mean, we can toss out some hypotheses, but I honestly, in the end, just don't really understand why. I mean, both sides have been subjected to the same kind of sort of institutionalization where major bloggers are picked off by media institutions on one way or the other, and there are other ways of rewarding bloggers who agree with an institutional line. But I'm not sure why you have a different set of patterns in conversations and in traffic in the right than in the left.
I should qualify what I'm saying about, you know, kind of internecine arguments, because as you say, there were some of those during the primary contests which did pit a kind of and it did pit kind of how far right are you going to go among the contestants. And there are these increasingly prominent sites. Is it the American Conservative? There are some interesting sort of attempts to intellectually reinvigorate conservatism that are a little unpredictable. Although, again, I almost feel like they're read more by left-wingers than they are by right-wingers.
Yeah, no, I don't think Daniel Larrison, David Frum, right? David Frum, who is a fixture of the right-wing establishment, from what I can tell, he is far more often cited by left-wingers than he's cited by right-wingers. And certainly Larrison, I think that's the case.
Yeah. But if you put that aside for a second, I mean, we should identify what that structure is. I mean, one of the things about – and we should also say that every hypothesis that we might put forward for the differences in that structure is going to run into trouble. And it's going to run into trouble because of the nature of the left-wing blog sphere in, say, 2004, 2005. I think, in the sense that, so one of the differences, right, is that the importance of the blog role, right, is much larger in the conservative blog sphere.
Right, right.
And I think that to the degree that the left-wing blog sphere has become much more hierarchical in terms of, in status, much more of a status hierarchy in terms of link behavior, right, there is much more lateral link exchange in the right-wing blogosphere. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. And I wonder if this can be traced down to the lack of a Gwen Reynolds. You know, so I wonder if there's a personal dynamic. First, yes, I think that is a correct pattern, that people on the right take links very seriously in a way that the blog role has almost disappeared as a consideration on the left, on left blogs, right? It used to be relevant, then sort of everybody kind of realized that not a lot of traffic came through a blog role, and Atrios, Duncan Black instituted a blog roll amnesty day, which meant that he could delete as many people from his blog roll as he liked without a loss of respect, right? Or at least it was an effort to do that. And you found sort of weird dynamics, like if your blog name started with an A, then you gained a great deal of traffic from being on a blog roll. And if it started with a Z, then you gained almost none because it was way down at the bottom of the blog roll. But I wonder how much of this particular structure can be laid at the feet of Glenn Reynolds in the right blogosphere, who has taken, I think, a very activist approach to supporting different small or medium-sized conservative blogs in a way that you've just never had a similar figure on the left. Even Duncan has not really been willing to play this role. And so I wonder if Instapundit has sort of built that structure around a set of personal preferences, and that structure is now enduring, those norms now endure in the right blogosphere in a way that they don't in the left.
Another possibility related to that is that, so you have Instapundit and so Glenn Reynolds would link to conservative blogs all the time, while Atrios, Duncan Black, would largely be uncovering news stories and kind of local papers that would get overlooked, right? That's sort of how I think of what the modus operandi of Atrios in its heyday was here's something in this local paper that's really interesting to left-wingers that you might not see. And then maybe that's not fair, but that's sort of, you know, I think, sort of described as uncovering stories you would have missed, right? And that obviously is a different pattern.
Right.
I also think that, I wonder, well, so some a site I don't understand very well is Memorandum. Right. But it seems like Memorandum does get a lot of conservative blogs on the sort of same page in terms of, you know, I know that occasionally we get linked in from that when we comment on something that's there, you know, like the blogs that comment on the things that are hot there show up there, and conservatives seem to use it a lot more. Is that just completely wrong? Am I 5 years?
No, I mean, I think that that's. I mean, I have Memorandum open right now. It's one of my tabs. Here's another thing. I wonder how much tabbed blogging, right? Sort of tabbed browsers with tabs have affected how much we've read blogging or read blogs. I don't even have a good hypothesis about how it would affect, but it certainly seems like something that might affect how we read blogs. Right-wingers tend to – I see Memorandum as an occasionally useful tool if I can't think of something to blog about, whereas right-wingers seem to have a much different approach to it, right? And perhaps a more utilitarian, but also a more prestige-oriented approach to it, where, I mean, they seem to go to some trouble to figure out the ways in which Memorandum finds stories and then to make sure that their stories, that their posts are found. But yeah, I mean, that's all I have to say about it. I don't know that much more about it, about Memorandum.
Well, it might lead to this hypothesis, which I think is probably wrong and might be a factor of being a left, you know, sort of a center lefty. I mean, I consider myself center right, but that's considered the larger discussion of where the American political scene is these days.
Right.
But, you know, being what would normally be called a kind of center lefty, looking into the right wing blog sphere and looking at bloggers that I used to engage with who I just can't anymore. And probably feel the same way about me. But I do get the sense that there's a sort of flogging of stories, which is more consistent across the right wing blog sphere, which looks more like the stories I see flogged on the symmetry is with the most partisan left wing community blogs. Right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are kinds of stories that get flogged at Daily Kos, right. That would show up, you know, maybe the dissemination point is Talking Points Memo or Daily Kos or something like that. And they get flogged around, you know, in kind of balloon juice in the places you'd expect. But they don't seem to be covered with a degree of relentlessness and the degree of similarity that you see if you kind of go to your usual suspects on the right wing or even sort of second-tier blogs on the right wing. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to say that, you know, oh my God, it's just – I don't think it's a question of people engaged, you know, it's the sort of standard left-wing argument was, you know, well, you've got, you know, non-independent thinkers echoing the line. But I do think it does feel like there is a faster dissemination of key arguments and repetition of them, much more, and maybe this is this more lateral structure that you have on the right side of the blog sphere. Does this make any sense? I'm not sure.
No, it does. It does. It completely makes sense in terms of sort of this willingness to link exchange and so forth. Mm-hmm. Another difference between sort of the blogosphere that exists in 2004 and the one that exists now, and this is true on both sides, is how some of the big sites have, you know, and I sort of think this has fallen off, right? But the rise of the diaries where people are making individualized contributions to sites. And we haven't even started talking about Twitter, right, and how Twitter has changed all this. Twitter has supported the institutionalization of the blogosphere.
Well, I think there are a whole bunch of things going on there. I mean, one thing is that I remember the rise of diaries, and I don't think diaries have survived that well outside of a couple of key, at least in the political blogosphere, outside of a couple of really high traffic sites. Think about
Red State and Daily Kos, right?
Think about the failure that was TPM Cafe.
Right.
That model has not disseminated the way that we might have expected, right?
Right.
Have models like the Huffington Post that essentially do that through having this huge stable of freebie bloggers, but it's not even the same thing, right? As a sort of decidedly third-tier blog in this world, Twitter has been terrific for us, I think. So you say that this institutionalizes the big blogs, and I think, yeah, it's true to some degree that it probably drives – the feedback effects are much greater for somebody who's, say, an IR blogging at foreignpolicy.com. But I think it's actually provided – because it's provided a forum for disseminating – links to pieces on blogs that have to be clicked through. I think it's really, I know it's increased our traffic a great deal. So has the sort of rise of Facebook as being a place where you can publicize these sorts of things.
Right. No. And at some point, and I think that LGM was even a little bit late to this, at some point there came to be a realization that if your web page was to be taken seriously, you needed a web page for your web page, right? Which is, right. You needed a Facebook page and a Twitter account in support of your web page in order to make it a powerful brand, which is so meta. But well, I mean, Can we drag this back?
Actually, where I want to we did all this discussion about the political blogosphere, and where I want to get us into how academic blogging fits into this story. But you want to drag this back somewhere else, so let's do that.
No, that's where I want to drag us back to. That's exactly where
we went a little bit further than I wanted to go, but I wanted to lay this groundwork because I think the first thing to recognize about academic political science blogging is that, like it or not, it does interface with an ecology which is dominated by politics blogs rather than political science blogs. And that's going to be your main non-political science audience are going to be coming from people who are reading political and often partisan blogs, even if you are not a political or partisan site.
Right.
So you want to drag this back. So what did you want to say?
Well, see, now I can't remember what I wanted to say. I guess that, you know, part of this, the part of the conversation that interests me is still, and I think this is what we've been doing for the last 20 minutes here, is how to go about explaining to outsiders within the academic world both, A, why the blogosphere is relevant, which is not really a hard case to make to anyone who's not just strikingly obtuse, but B, sort of all of the dynamics of how this system has changed, how the rewards and the costs have changed over time, and how all of these are to sort of everything we talked about changes how we evaluate the whatever scholarly contribution blogging might make, right? Or to phrase it differently, whatever contribution blogging might make to a sort of standard scholarly career, you know, which is obviously something that's of interest to me, given the relevance of this part of my career to my life and my career. And so I guess that's the direction that I'm particularly interested in. I mean, I'm also very interested in how sort of political science appears in the blogosphere and how it comes to be interpreted and people understand what we do in political science through the blogosphere, although that's sort of a second order concern for me.
Well, I don't think it's a second order concern at all. And I'm looking – so there are a couple of things that are worth pursuing, right? The first is – so we've spent a lot of time, as you say, analyzing the structure of the blogosphere and the political blogosphere, which, you know, I've sort of stipulated that I think is going to be relevant to anybody who does political science blogging. Because the natural audience of people who are not political scientists who give a damn about what you have to say are going to be people who are interested in politics, which means they're going to be involved in the politics – the partisan politics blogosphere, right? Number two, that there's now an increasing sense that blogging is where political science should go. And I don't mean in terms of we should give up scholarly content. Nobody's making that argument, or give up journal publications. Nobody's really making that argument, or change the way we evaluate tenure. People aren't really making that argument, although some are starting to, which is interesting. But more in the sense that, you know, I think I remember reading a newsletter of one of the APSA sections a couple of years ago where the editor implored more people in their section to blog. There's a kind of notion that, you know, you can just set up a blog and that's an important part of what you do. You see graduate student web pages, you know, we sort of – I remember going through an evolution where nobody had web pages. And then people who were kind of cool – and could do some HTML had web pages. And then, you know, and I'm going to skip over a bunch. You start to have blogs and like, ooh, you know, what is this stuff? And then it became de regular that everybody on the job market, every political scientist almost has a web page that may not even be an institutional web page. And often now those web pages are built in WordPress. And often now they have a blog, right? How active that blog is varies, but there's an increasing sense that this is something that you're supposed to do. But it seems to me that after that, things get really murky, you know, that there are people who seem to think that if you simply have a blog, all of a sudden you'll get lots of readers, right? That it's kind of this magical mystery. It's not a magical mystery land, but it's a, you know, that there's gold everywhere, right? It's like the gold rush, you know.
Right.
There are people who seem to think that, you know, it's just a kind of, that what blogging entails is writing an op-ed every week, but self-publishing it.
Right.
There are people who really seem to get it and get it quickly. There's almost a kind of training system now, you know, sort of people who might guest blog somewhere and then they set up their own blog. So if you think about, you know, so there's a whole set of different things going on, but academics are moving into this niche and not always understanding what they're doing, right? And at the same time, there are different purposes, right, which is what you were getting into. And I know that, you know, the big model that has captured the attention of a lot of my colleagues is the monkey cage.
Right, right.
Indeed, one of my colleagues blogs at the monkey cage. But I know that, you know, among people who have been academics who have been blogging for a long time, I don't think anybody dislikes the monkey cage. It's done a lot of wonderful things. But there is a sense that the mission of the monkey cage is very distinctive from why a lot of other people are academically blogging, and that it might be crowding out some of those other arguments. I don't know if that's the right way to put it.
No, I think that's correct. You know, strangely enough, I have a forthcoming article on sort of the monkey cage and other political blogging in an actual political science journal.
Oh, really? Where is it coming out? Where should we be looking forward to this?
Yeah, sure. In April, it's coming out in PS.
Excellent. Okay.
So, the monkey cage is obviously sort of a fantastic achievement. And, I mean, it's not just the monkey cage anymore, right? Because it's also now moved on to the Washington Post, and John Seitz has done guest blogging at 538, the New York Times version of 538. And so it's sort of the monkey cage brand is moving beyond simply the monkey cage. It is not clear to me where the monkey cage falls in this conversation about how blogging fits into political science. And I think this echoes some of what you just said, right? I mean, it's a very specific kind of political science that they do at the monkey cage. And it's sort of almost inspiring that you can have a blog dedicated to, you know, quantitative Americanist political science that nonetheless renders itself sort of very well read and very, very and I'm sure you and I, or you probably with your IR colleagues, joked about how boring American politics was, and it's only just, you know, one case in a comparative, and blah blah blah. But they've certainly done good work in terms of making the monkey cage relevant, and that's extremely impressive. I do worry that the monkey cage will become a model for how professional political scientists are supposed to act, right? How even when they blog, how they are supposed to behave, when in fact there are several models for political scientists to behave within the blogosphere.
So what would be some of those other models? Stephen Wald is
a model. Dan Dresner is a model. And these are different than the monkey cage, which is about sort of very interesting and often humorous, but also a very straightforward relation of of basic political science research, whereas Walt and Dresner and Stephen Taylor and other early Walt obviously is not an early blogosphere adopter, but Dresner is, sort of take the political science research and take it in a variety of interesting directions. And so sort of don't feel, even with Dresner, don't feel constrained by academic neutrality or academic distance to make comments about genuine policy in the way that sometimes the monkey cage feels constrained and feels restrained just reading it. I don't know. I mean, those are my initial thoughts. What do you mean when you think that the monkey cage may be becoming this model or becoming the elephant in the room? I can't remember how you characterized it exactly. But.
Yeah, I can't remember either. I mean, one of the things you have to be careful is that whenever, you know, I always worry in talking about very successful blogs that come out of my discipline that some of what I say will be touched by resentment in the sense that, you know, a lot of people who are around for beforehand might look at the monkey cage and say, wow, you know, they have gotten all these accolades, you know, oh, woe is me or what have you. And sometimes I do feel a little bit like, you know, what is it? We're always insecure in academia. So you have to be careful about that. But I do think that there are two aspects of the monkey cage. I'm feeling very deja vu, and I don't know whether I've discussed this on a podcast before or something, which I don't think are wrong, but I think are different than a lot of academic bloggers. So one aspect of it is that the monkey cage is very much about establishing the credibility of political science as a form of science that should inform primarily journalism and then secondarily policymaking.
Right.
And that is a real niche. And the monkey cage has done there has been incredible, which is to say that no matter what you think about the certainty with which certain political science is presented at the monkey cage, it is 99.99999% better than what you get out of standard political journalism.
Right.
So, you know, so that is enormously huge and productive and wonderful, right?
Jonathan Bernstein would also, I think, fall into sort of that particular category of how to approach the relationship between political science and journalism.
So just getting journalists to say things that are accurate.
Right, exactly.
And to, to say things that are accurate and to cover things that may matter more.
Right, and internally, to say things that are internally coherent, right? I mean, you know, accuracy is almost even a second-order concern beyond the internally coherent, right? Something that, you know, your premise A meets with your premise B, which political science, I think, does well,
right,
and journalists do poorly. But
and there are actually structural reasons why a lot of what goes on in American politics are particularly well-suited to this, right?
Right.
I mean, we can talk about the small end of presidential contests and the way that that should make us be a little bit careful about over-interpreting some of the results we get when we get to sort of models of presidential political outcomes. But on the flip side of that, you know, a lot of voting happens. We have very good data about a lot of the voting that happens. A lot of public opinion surveys happen. We accumulate a lot of data about that. So there's ways in which a lot of the sort of men in white lab coats quantitative techniques are particularly well-suited in American politics and the kinds of things that American politics people study,
right,
that make it, you know, a really nice fit, right? Of course, there is comparative politics and a IR component, both of which are very strong at the monkey cage. So on the one hand, I think that that model is a particular model about establishing political science. And I think a lot of how you feel about that comes down to how you feel about it when you see the phrase political scientist X argues that, right? And
right,
for some people, I think that is terrific because now we're talking about political scientists qua scientists. For me, I find it a little grating, you know, in the sense that I'm not convinced that what we do should be harped on repeatedly as being a science to, in the sense of borrowing the cachet from the natural sciences, as opposed to just being social scientists. But, you know, so I think that has something to do with it. I think I had an exchange with John or somebody from the monkey cage to the extent of, you know, maybe we call ourselves politicologists or something, you know,
right,
but that isn't it odd that we're one of the few social scientists that has the term science in our name, right? Sociologists who do plenty of high-tech quantitative work or economists don't call themselves economic scientists or sociological scientists, right? So point one is the kind of the mission, which is very different, I think, than a lot of the other mission, right? The other missions we might talk about. And point number two is that I don't think that my persistent concern with the monkey cage has not been about anything that they do, because what they do wonderfully. It's about not necessarily how not everybody. Okay, I'm almost feeling like I need to edit this out because I have to be careful about the way I say this. I think that I have seen indications that people at the monkey cage do not always recognize the role that they play, the positive role they play as a hub for other political scientists, which is to say that sometimes there is a relentless focus on the notion of communication of political science research to non-political scientists and a mm-hmm. lack of recognition that one of the big things that blogs do is build intellectual community among people who are engaged in a discipline.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I think it actually is playing that role. That is, a lot of political scientists go and read The Monkey Cage, but there isn't necessarily recognition that that role is something that needs to be more actively serviced and nurtured, right? Except for in the form of sort of promulgating research. The third thing is, of course, gets into the sort of more nitty-gritty, which is that I am not entirely comfortable with the way in which international relations work is presented as being cumulative and as solid as a kind of guide to policy as the American politics work is sometimes presented.
Right.
And I'm also uncomfortable with the way that some of the American politics work is presented. So, you know, I largely, for example, buy a kind of structural model. I think the economy determines a great deal of what happens in elections. But I think that the percentage it doesn't deal with is often the decisive percentage in elections. Right. And I'm a little bit uncomfortable with people who insist so strongly that campaigns don't matter, or because it's hard to get rid of endogeneity problems in indicating the effects of campaigning, that we should treat them as they don't matter. But regardless of how we do that in American politics, which is not my field, and I probably just made myself look like an idiot talking about, a lot of the work in IR has not – I would not be comfortable presenting a lot of even some of the best work in IR as being – something that I would say, we have found the truth about a relationship here, and therefore we should do X. And when you start doing that on blogs, I feel very uncomfortable.
This has been a very sort of intellectually productive argument or discussion here for me, because it does kind of, to some extent, inform how I think about the differences between Monkey Cage and a blog like Lawyers, Guns, and Money, where most of the bloggers are professional political scientists, and something like 90% of the posts have been written by political scientists. But the framing might be provided by one of the bloggers who's not a political scientist, and that's Eric Loomis, and who sort of told me about the history field and has sort of indicated how he's a historian, so he knows about the history field, how oddly non-cumulative the academic field of history is, that there are effectively very few reasons for history to operate in a cumulative fashion. Because, you know, original research is rewarded over secondary sources. When people are selecting dissertation topics, one of the ways they go about it, has a book been written about this in the last 30 years? Well, if not, then that's a great dissertation topic, which effectively is renewing the discipline every 30 years or so, right? Often based on the same original research. And so... the value of a PhD in political science or history as a blogger might be less in terms of the direct relation of elements of your expertise, whether they be in international relations or with it in terms of Scotland, you know, in terms of constitutional law, or in Eric's terms, in terms of the sort of history of Western environmentalism, but rather in terms of the set of tools that you developed as a political scientist in the first half of your graduate school career, which is a broad familiarity with the literature and a broad familiarity with how the literature conflicts with itself, with the set of tools that you have for evaluating empirical events and for constructing relevant, interesting, compelling theories, and then evaluating those theories, that perhaps we ought to think about the contribution of the political scientist more in terms of this is the way that political scientists might think about this issue than this is what political scientists have discovered or unveiled or revealed about this question. And I think that that does get to some tension between how Americanists view the academic universe and how international relations scholars view the academic universe.
Well, although with the caveat that I think IR is going the way of American, so.
And IR, in fact, may be going in the way of American, which we can celebrate or bemoan.
I think they're good and bad things.
Based on where we happen to be trying to get tenure. But anyway.
Well, but that's interesting because now I'm starting to think about there might be actually a series of types, and we could talk about those typologies. So there's the Monkey Cage, which is about which is primarily about communicating political science research. Although there's a lot of other interesting things going on there, and it's really fun to watch Andrew Gelman, sort of rip apart bad social science and I think Eric, my colleague, is just as likely to actually, do what you talked about, bring political science to bear on a set of questions. So he had that fantastic post on the rejection of the Disabilities Treaty. Mm-hmm. We sort of talked about, okay, well, here's sort of what we think we know from political science about the relative implications of signing or not signing that treaty, and that might inform our assessment of whether it was a good or bad thing in certain ways, right? And I thought it was a nice way of doing that. Mm-hmm. And that sort of bleeds you into sort of what somebody like Dan Dresner does, which I think is much more in the model that you were just discussing. So there's the model of we're presenting political science research and we're trying to correct systematic misunderstandings in some zone that's close to our research. We're bringing, scholarly research and often quantitative work to bear on those sets of questions, right? So maybe that's the monkey cage model. And there's a question about giving political science a larger voice and making it more legitimate, right? That I think is sort of a central concern there. For something like Dan, there's a model which is to say that where I think what Dan does is much more along the lines of he has some hobby horses that are directly related to his work.
Mm-hmm,
things like globalization. For a long time, it was globalization, right? And race to the bottom arguments. We're actually having to disagree with Dan, but that's a whole other story. Mm-hmm. Or sanctions or things like that. But primarily, he's about sort of in a kind of witty, accessible way, bringing a kind of political science-y or IRE style and to policy concerns, right?
Right.
Which is, right. I think, in the idiom you just described where, what's really most important is his familiarity with the literature, his engagement as both an academic and somebody who's involved in sort of CFR type of activities, right? Mm-hmm. Council Foreign Relations type of activities. You're saying like Steve Walt, who is really doing something closer to kind of extended opinion editorial writing.
Right.
Where with a kind of compass, which is based on his sort of particular brand of realism, right? So where the academic background is really about a style of reasoning, a style of argument, and a particular kind of worldview. I think the primary group of political science bloggers, I think the most common are actually those who are simply have really strong specialties in some area. And so they become important public resources for talking about that area, right? They're Middle East specialists. Or they're specific to a particular country even, right? Mm-hmm. And so they're, think about Texas and Africa, which is less active now as a blog. I mean, Laura is much more activist, active on Twitter. But there was a set of substantive expertise that she had that became very important to a set of policy debates, right? Or you think about the development blog community, right, where, you can have people who are both presenting political, economics, political science research, both promulgating it and engaging in whatever. But, really it's kind of, I am an expert on this. I know a heck of a lot about it. And let's have a kind of intellectual conversation about it. So there are sort of, what I'd say, people who it's their specialist background and their deep expertise. There are people whom it's a mode of reasoning that they then are engaging in a more public and formal way with. There are people for whom it's the kind of a mission, the mission we've described, I think, unfairly with the monkey cage as a whole, but particularly with a subset of what happens at the monkey cage. But the model that I'm interested in, right, is the model about kind of having kind of disciplinary discussions, the idea of building intellectual community that's inclusive of not just people who are in academia, but is inclusive of people who are informed or have, you know, sort of the, you know, autodidactic or academia curious, right? And that's mm-hmm. the model that I think we've sort of settled on at the Duck of Minerva. And that's the model that I'm sort of most interested in personally. But I don't know. I mean, is that an exhaustive list of models, or am I missing something?
You know, I can't off the top of my head think of any others. I mean, I'm wondering about other disciplines and how other disciplines might fit into this. But I mean, I guess I am really – what fascinates me about that is – about the last part of the discussion is sort of the model you're trying to work up at the Duck of Minerva, which we're on right now, where you are discussing relatively complex political science issues for what appear to be a fairly substantial community for those kinds of issues, right? And so I guess I'm sort of curious, what is your sense of, your political science readership, your cross-academic readership, your autodidact readership? I mean, from those categories that you mentioned, I mean, where do you think most of it comes from? Is it, so you said like something like 1 to 2,000 a day. I mean, are those mostly, do you think that's a significant percentage of the international relations professionals in America? I mean, I'm quite curious.
Well, I don't know. I mean, also, you know, we're sort of our concerns tend to be more friendly to kind of European.
Right. No, that's true.
Definitely. A lot of kind of posties, as it were, but we've really diversified lately. I mean, that's mm-hmm. one of the things we've really been trying to do. And I think it's been good. I think that, you know, I don't know. I don't drill down enough. I like to watch our general ebb and flow, but I don't really, you know, and I also know that we have, that the RSS readership is larger, and that's harder to track because I don't use the techniques that would allow me to do that. But I would say this, that as I become less concerned with that, what's struck me more is the I am surprised by the number of people I meet in the field who tell me that they read the blog,
mm-hmm.
you know, and some of that obviously is, you know, they know of it's enough of its existence and it's a nice thing to say to you. But you know, people who I say, oh, you know, hi, I'm Dan Nexon, who are you? And they're like, oh, wait, you're like the duck guy, right? You know, yeah, I read that blog. Right. So I'm surprised by the number of people who say that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm surprised by the number of people who, but I also know that a lot of our core community are people who I think are more, you know, a lot of the people who do comment regularly, we don't have a big commenting community, I think mm-hmm. are people who are sort of, they tend to be grad students or they tend to be people with a political science background who are not in the community anymore. So I do think that there is a significant community like that. I mean, we do have a large number of readers who come from federal agencies, which suggests to me that, you know, we're getting people who are not professional political scientists. Mm-hmm. And we do have a significant number of a large number of graduate students. I have an increasing number of conversations with people who are interested in grad school who know the blog, because they'll say, well, you need to read my post on writing an application. They say, yes, I've read it.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what that mix is, but I know that our penetration in the IR community is larger than I assumed it was, but it's not composed of people who read the blog every day, you know, in the sense that academic reading patterns are not like blogger reading patterns,
okay.
right?
Yeah, no,
and Secondly, I know that a lot of the people who I engage with intellectually now are not necessarily professional academics, and a lot of that I think has been the effect of Twitter.
Right.
But I would say that the big thing, even if regardless of the numbers, the thing that excites me about what's been happening at the blog in the last year or two isn't just sort of readership, isn't just the expansion of the RSS feed, it isn't just these other types of objective measures. It's the sense that by being active in an IR blog, an IR academic blog sphere.
Yes. 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 Sorry.
Oh, it's okay. We've been on for a long time. And probably this has gotten too long, and I'm not really sure what to do about that. But the people who are in the academic IR that I now interact with people in the field who, if I were to just go to conferences and do my thing, I would never interact with, right? That's the thing that I find really exciting, and that's really been what's been shaping my view of the role of blogging in IR academia lately. So I'm interacting with a lot more people who don't do the kinds of methodological work that I do.
Right.
You know, whether it be people on the sort of more critical spectrum, or whether it be people who do formal modeling or really heavy duty statistical work, I interact with them through blogging in a way that I would not, I think, interact otherwise. I interact with these sort of young gun, the people you do, the sort of Nat security tweeters and stuff, right? Who have something to say often about stuff that we talk about in academia, but would not be part of the journal conversation. Right.
Oh, good Lord. Yeah, no, I mean, I just don't know how to deal with a character like Dan Trombley, right?
he's Exhibit A, right? You know,
but go on. What did you say?
He's Exhibit A, but go of.
Right,
yeah.
Well, who writes just this, you know, not above critique, but this sort of fantastically interesting, and all he has is an undergraduate degree, but this fantastically interesting sort of IR and deeply informed IR work on his blog, right? And it's, well, and he's going to be on Blogging Guys actually this week. He's going to be on Foreign Entanglements. But how, you know, sort of how am I supposed to, as a political scientist, go about evaluating what appears to be his very interesting effort at a contribution to sort of the realist policymaking framework, right? And I think they've now discussed his contribution in terms of kilotrombolies, right? How many thousands of words that he writes about a particular subject because he has just an enormous output on his blog. But it's very hard to sort of figure out what to do with him in the context of what I still sort of allocate in terms of respect for professionalism in IR, right? Which is, you know, still many of the things that you and I have gone through in terms of graduate school and dissertation writing and so forth. And so how then do I think about his contributions and the contributions of these others, Adam Elkus and others who are similar to him, and what they have to contribute in a way that is just completely outside of the normal channels of thinking about international relations theory.
Well, that's the thing that I think is what we, and I've said this before, and this is the point that Charlie's made, that we need to get used to, we need to start figuring out how that's going to look. And, you know, this is the point of arguing that there are certainly some things in academia that are going on blogs that we need to pay attention to as a discipline. You know, I think some of that is stuff that's getting squeezed out of journals, so a lot of the better kind of IR theorizing is happening sometimes on blogs. So you talk about, you know, if you want, there's nothing interesting going on in realism except for what you just described, which is not being done by, I'm sorry, realist friends, but there's nothing interesting going on in kind of what realist theory is about, except for by people who are interested in realist theory and are not in the club, you know, in the academic club necessarily. But there's also this weird niche, which we get as some of our guest posts, and you also get at Political Violence at a Glance, which I sort of see as being more Monkey Cage-esque in its orientation, but somewhere in between, which is I'm an academic, I have something to say, but it's not just reporting my findings, it's active intervention in an ongoing argument. It's too scholarly to put on an op-ed page. but it's not scholarly enough and the time frame is too short for me to try to publish it. Mm-hmm. And that's also an interesting dimension of what's happening in you know, that academic blogging allows, right? So this, God, have I talked about this in the podcast already? This feels really deja vu-ish, but you think about the stuff that went on with the human security report,
right?
And the blogging that went on at a bunch of places about that, which was really, would not have, there was no other obvious outlet for it, right? Except for in blogs. But because it was both scholarly and very pointed critique, but also, you know, so it was an op-ed, it wasn't never going to make an op-ed page, but it was also, you know, never going to get published in a journal.
Right.
So we've been going on for a really long time. We've barely scratched the surface, and that's sort of my fault because I didn't provide a structure for this. So I'm thinking that, you know, maybe we should stop.
I think that finding a good endpoint is ideal because I don't know what my wife is doing. She was looking for me for some reason.
Yeah,
so,
and that's never good when you've got.
Yeah, no, I think it's now
twins.
A good time, but we should do this again.
Well, right?
People do 2-part podcasts.
Well, so. Actually, what I think we should talk about doing, this is really long, and I'm going to try to edit it and sort of see what I can do with it. But I think what we should start thinking about doing is maybe we can do something that's shorter and more listenable and less of a time thing. I mean, I know that you've got podcasting plans, but maybe we could start, you know, doing smaller, manageable chunks that are, you know, of something which are 10 to 15 or 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. Do a couple of those. I don't know what we should do. Anyway, thank you. I hope that at least this was provided some educational benefit for people who are academics who are thinking about blogging and don't know their way around the blogosphere at all. And I really want to thank you for coming on and doing that because, you know, you really are one of the few people who has, you know, both understands academia very well, but is also a really just a prominent blogger in your own right. That is, I think the problem, you know, you're a lot of people who make it in a lot of the people we make it in blogging, I think, are thought of primarily as, well, let me put it this way. You have an audience as a scholar, you have an argument audience as a scholar blogger, and then you have an audience as kind of a pure blogger. Right. And I can't think of too many people who fit those three categories. Right. And you do. So your perspective is particularly, I think, valuable, I hope, for our listeners. So thanks for coming on.
Well, no, thanks for having me, Dan. I'm not sure about all that, but it sounds good. So, sort of the final thing is that LGM is considering doing some podcasts, and so it might this is certainly a learning experience, we'll say one thing. So we might be able to have sort of a back and forth thing on this between the two podcasts that hopefully will come to exist.
Yeah, sounds great. Okay, so long.
All right.
You've come to the merciful end of another Duck of Minerva podcast. This episode number 16, was recorded on December 13th, 2012. Hope you got something out of it. Bye.